Yeah, make him laugh, make him laugh. Bet you all tired of hearing the constant blather. In the end, you just wanna know that laughing matters. From entrepreneurs to Fortune 500, humor makes the world go round. You didn't know? It's a fit for a pro, like a roll with spaghetti, to keep your culture light when times are heavy. So sit back and relax as you raise the bar, when it all comes down to the ha ha ha. Yeah, make him laugh, huh? You make him laugh, make him laugh.
Welcome to Laughing Matters, a podcast like no other, and I'm not sure if that's good, bad, or otherwise, but in Laughing Matters, we explore the power of humor and laughter in a world sorely lacking both, and how leaders from all walks of life use humor to take the edge off. We'd like to think that Laughing Matters is of the moment, and frankly, we've never needed humor and laughter more. I am your host, Steve Cody. I am founder and CEO of Peppercom, which is named in honor of my late Black Labrador Retriever, Pepper. And I'm joined by my co-host, Peppercom Senior VP, Paul Mershon. Paul?
Steve, you know, what a wonderful irony that you and I, by our own admission, are really not that funny, but we get to host a podcast called Laughing Matters. I mean, that just tells you how great America is, doesn't it?
Well, I consider myself funny, Paul, so I take that as an insult.
Oh, my goodness.
But we have an individual, Paul, who is funnier, far funnier, and far more accomplished than you and I can ever dream of being. So we are absolutely thrilled to have with us a veteran, or as interns refer to me, a seasoned veteran in the world of journalism and the legal space. He's currently a legal analyst for CNN and has covered the O.J. Simpson murder trial, the Clinton impeachment, and the Mueller investigation. That's some heavy duty stuff. He's also served in various leadership roles with the US Department of Justice as an internationally recognized expert on anti-money laundering, narcotics. I'd like to have a side discussion about narcotics with you at some point in time. And terrorist financing. His name is Michael Zeldin. Please welcome Michael to Laughing Matters. Thank you so much, Michael.
Awesome. Michael, welcome. How are you doing today? It's a wonderful day where you are.
It's a wonderful day in Washington. It's always a wonderful day in Washington. Thank you so much for inviting me on the show.
Glad to hear that, Michael. And that you have such an optimistic view of Washington. We'll get into some of that here today. But we wanted to kick off asking me, obviously, Steve gave a wonderful introduction and you've had some great experience and background in your journalism career. You mentioned the Clinton impeachment, Mueller investigation, some serious roles as an attorney in the U.S. Department of Justice. As Steve mentioned, that's a lot of deep stuff in there. How on earth do you find humor in the middle of all of that? And I mean, were there any moments in your career, in your life, where using laughter, using humor have helped you deal with the gravity of dealing with these deep types of situations?
Well, fundamentally, it seems to me that if you can't find humor in these situations, you'll just go insane because the gravity, as you call it, of them is so overwhelming that if you stay focused on that without finding, you know, bits of humor in it, you just can't really process it all. So, for example, in the O.J. Simpson trial, in the case, there's that famous bit where O.J. is doing this essentially slow drive car chase on the highway. He's in the van and
the white Ford Bronco, right?
And I'm watching that and I'm thinking, and on the one hand, this is, you know, pathetic. On the other hand, my TV script, you know, view is watching this thinking, this is a riot. I mean, they have every police officer following this Bronco. All they need to do is drive in front of it, for God's sakes, if they want to stop him. And you watch this on and on and on, and it becomes, you know, funny. To me, it becomes funny. And so you find the humor in it. I had a case when I was a defense attorney where we had a witness. He was actually the defendant to be, it turned out. And he was, you know, not the brightest guy. And he was going to go into the grand jury. And in the grand jury, he's not allowed to have his attorney with us. And so we said to him, you know, essentially, you're not that smart. What we want you to do is anytime they ask you a substantive question about which you don't know the answer, ask them, as is your right, to come out to say you want to talk to your lawyer. You got it? Got it. He goes in. 2 seconds later, he's out. And we say, you know, essentially, what's the problem? He said, well, they wanted to know whether I swear to tell the truth. And I told him I wanted to consult with my lawyer. You know, so, I mean, the guy was indicted for, you know, multiple murders. But if you don't find humor in representing a guy who says to the grand jury who's thinking about indicting him that he wants to talk to his lawyer about whether he should swear to tell the truth, then you're missing the point.
And obviously a member of Mensa as well.
He was a member of Mensa.
Follow-up question, which is really happening right now, and that's, how do you deal with the ridiculous, bizarre, counter-parallel universe statements coming out of Capitol Hill, and in particular, what Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, said in terms of comparing mask and vaccine mandates to the Holocaust? How do you and the, you know, the White House press corps, your peers, how do you deal with something that onerous? I mean, how does humor help you just not? And again, it's just so, but this is your life day in and day out covering these individuals.
So you've got two choices with Marjorie Taylor Greene or Tucker Carlson, which is to take them as serious people who are making serious points that wearing a mask is like the Holocaust, or the COVID safety protocols is like medical Jim Crow, which is what Tucker Carlson just said. And you can take it seriously and get all offended and bothered and, you know, give it a lot of airtime of this is, you know, Chicken Little and the world is coming to an end. Or you could just say, this is so absurd. This is so stupid. These people are so stupid. And just move on and just not give it seriousness. I think I tweeted something about the problem with the media is they give it attention as if it was a serious, as if it is something that deserves serious attention. And that is the oxygen that they live for. And so in some sense, you're better off saying these people are lunatics. These are absurd questions. They're statements that they need to be laughed at, and you got to move on. And, you know, like with Donald Trump, in some sense, what is the thing that you could do to hurt him the most if that's what you want to do? And the answer is ignore him. Smile and you know, what you think is absurd, and move on. If you give it seriousness, you give it oxygen. And so, you know, from my politics and my coverage of things, I like to find these things to be absurd, humorous, and not, you know, wring my hands over them. And I think that's actually a good lesson in a lot of things. You can find lots of things about which to aggravate, or you can just move on and smile and say, this is just not worth my time.
Yeah, but these folks think that they're funny, though, right, Mike? I mean, they think that they're, you know, creative and they're punchy and that the stuff that they're saying resonates, right, with certain audiences. I mean, they really truly think that they've got it figured out and they're funny, right?
Well, some of them, you know, you have to understand that there are people like Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham, and I'm sure there are people on other stations too, who are not journalists. They're the Andrew Dice Clay of journalism. They're shock opinion people. And if you watch them in those terms, you can watch them like you watch Andrew Dice Clay if you choose to watch him, and, you know, find aspects of what they say to be funny or not worthy of any attention. I just don't give serious consideration to what they say as a means of, you know, sort of laughing it off, if you will, because they are there not to inform, but rather to shock.
To entertain, right.
And so these are entertainers. They're not journalists.
Right. And the same could be said with our former president, his method of leading, right, more from an entertainment perspective as well.
Just say, I am looking forward to his reinstatement in August.
I wanted to follow up, Michael, with, you know, what seemingly is an oxymoron, politicians and humor. But I think back to Lincoln, I think to JFK, Reagan, Obama, who had the ability to use humor to either make a point or diffuse a very intense situation. Who on Capitol Hill would you say actually has a great sense of humor, uses it in a self-deprecating way, in a positive, upbeat way, or is there no such animal?
Well, I actually haven't met too many politicians that I think are really, you know, drop dead funny people. I thought that in all the years that I went to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, that George Bush was the funniest of them. I mean, I think he would have been
much, right?
He would have been much funnier as a much happier as a humorist. The world would have been much happier were he a humorist. But I thought George Bush really had a very nice style. He could deliver a line. He could be self-deprecating. And so he's among my favorite, you know, sort of humorist politicians. Obama, I thought, was able to deliver something written for him, but it was too clear to me that it was written for him. And then, of course, at the 2011 White House Correspondent Dinner, where he wouldn't let up on teasing Trump, and you could see Trump getting madder and madder, the consequence of going a bit too far there was that when Trump accidentally became president, he did everything in his powers to get even with Obama. You have to watch that 2011 White House Correspondents YouTube link, and you'll understand why Donald Trump had it in for Barack Obama. In current politicians, I thought that Jamie Raskin, actually, during the second impeachment, he was the lead impeachment manager, had a very nice style about him. There was nothing funny about what he was doing, but I've met him once or twice, independent of my coverage of the impeachment. And I think he's got a very nice style about him. And he looks a little bit like Harpo Marx.
And so, Michael, who do you think is funnier, lawyers, journalists, or politicians, and why?
Oh, I think politicians by far, because of the absurdity of what they say. That cohort is, you know, just so funny in the sense of they can say things 2 minutes apart that are diametrically opposite of one another without blanching for a moment and not seeing sort of the humor in it. I think that lawyers and journalists mostly are self-serious and like to be taken seriously. I don't think politicians generally behave similarly. So I would take politicians just because of the absurdity of how they speak and the inconsistency of their thoughts, holding two diametrically inconsistent thoughts in their head at the same time without recognition of the fact that they are inconsistent. That's pretty funny to me.
Sounds like the definition of me, Michael.
Well, you know, we all have that to a certain extent, but these guys, I just find an incredibly funny group, in if you define funny as absurd. It doesn't have to be, you know, Jerry Seinfeld or Henny Youngman, right? Joke after joke, but just, you know, again, finding humor in the fact of the way they behave.
In terms of a laughing matter that helps shape the person you are today, any cringeworthy moment that you can look back at and laugh at that made you more open to self-deprecating humor, or an event that helped you understand how powerful humor can be as one of life's learning lessons?
So you'd have to have met my father to know that he was channeling Henny Youngman in the Borscht Belt comedians all the time. You know, and so in my first appearance on television, way back, I guess at around the O.J. Simpson trial, I said, "Dad, I'm going to be on television." And he said, "Son," essentially, he didn't call me son, but he'd say Michael. He said, "You have a face for radio." and so that was, he didn't say this is the coolest thing ever or anything like that. He used that, you know, worn joke of "you have a face for radio," which I hadn't even heard, you know. And I thought to myself, oh my God, you know. So I sort of trained at his knee, and he was a beloved fellow because he always tried to interject humor into all settings. His name was Benjamin, and we called him Benji, and we'd always say, "Ben, enough, you know, enough." But he was loved for his, you know, staccato joke after joke after joke. That's how I grew up. And so in life, I've always remembered that I have a face for radio and, you know, again, didn't take myself so seriously and have used it, you know, throughout my career. So for example, when I was in different positions in life where I was hiring people, whether they were prosecutors in the Department of Justice, or when I was a partner at a global consulting firm in charge of the money laundering and sanctions practice, when someone would come in, I'd study their resume, I'd know what their qualifications were. I'd say to them, essentially, my first question, tell me a story. And if they couldn't tell me a story that sort of like made me smile, they weren't going to get past me as a hirer. When I was trying cases back in the day, the lawyers used to be able to ask prospective jurors all the questions. Now the judges pretty much have taken that over. And when I would be, they called it voir dire, questioning prospective jurors to see which 12 would sit on my trial, I would always say something which I considered to be funny or clever or, you know, a smile sort of moment. And I'd say it and I'd look at the jurors, and any juror that grimaced, I would strike. You know, you have a right in jury trials to strike what they call peremptorily those jurors that you just don't want for whatever reason, as long as it's not, you know, sex or race protected jurors. If you don't like blue shirts, you can strike someone. You have a certain number of them. If they didn't smile when I said one of my silly jokes, I struck them, because I figured that if I can't create that rapport, that smile to smile, humor to humor rapport, I had no chance in convincing them of the innocence of my clients or the guilt of the defendant.
That's beautiful. So you read the audience, in effect.
I tried to, you know, I lost my fair share of cases, but, you know, but they smiled, you know, so that was the victory, I suppose.
And I think your, you know, tell me a story interview technique is so applicable to certainly what we do and what the entire business world. That's a great tip as far as I'm concerned.
For me, it worked because, you know, when you're pitching business or in a negotiation, to disarm and in some sense befriend, to me, was always a much more successful strategy than, you know, being the tough opponent who gives no inches. I remember I was pitching work when I was in the private sector, and I walk into the guy's office, and in his office is a picture of the Mormon temple here in Washington. It's a beautiful building. It sits on top of a hill right outside of Rock Creek Park. And he has it on his wall. And I sit down and I said to him, I look at that photo and I say to him, that picture gives me a lot of pain. And that's not what you really say about someone's religion. And he gives me this like, what the sort of look. And I said, yeah. So for a long time, I raced bicycles and I did my hill training on the hill on which that edifice, that beautiful edifice, sits. And so every time I see it, I think of, oh my God, I've got to go up this hill 40 times today and my legs are going to be on fire. Well, he laughed because it was like, what is this guy going to insult Mormonism? Yeah, and I said, oh no, my legs hurt looking at it. And everything, you know, sort of like the deal was sealed at that moment because we connected.
And that is a home run in stand-up comedy. You surprise the audience with an unexpected finish to the opening. So you completely surprised and delighted him.
Took him off guard. Yeah, absolutely.
The danger, of course, is that someone might not have a sense of humor about these things. And then I would have probably been, you know, tossed out of my ear. And so you have to make these choices. You know, when do you take that chance, if you will? But I always took that chance because I always felt that I had the greatest chance of making a human connection through humor. And that would create a comfort between us that would make either the sale complete or the working relationship. Because we had this foundation of like, how did you guys meet? Oh, well, I met when I insulted, you know, his religion, you know, and no, he didn't insult my religion. And that was the foundation upon which the relationship gets built. And there are stories like that throughout my career, because that's how I always behave.
Yeah, and that's pretty much the way Peppercom behaves. It's why we win so few new pieces of business.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, well, so it's funny, Michael, because that's my religion and my temple. I got married there, actually. So I was wondering, where are you going to go with this? They're like, oh, wow. It's probably his reaction, too. But that's really the way you can develop those relationships with people. So that's a wonderful story. I did want to pivot here and ask a little bit as far as how stand-up and laughter is being implemented within academia. We know that you've taught at the Harvard Kennedy School Institute of Politics, Michael. And one of the things that we learned recently is that Stanford University made stand-up comedy as a required 3-credit course for all of its MBA students. We haven't seen this before in academia. And so being that you have taught in college, what do you think about it? Do you think it'll catch on? Do you think that this is a notion that academics and business people and politicians, like, for example, we mentioned earlier, JFK, Reagan, they're beginning to see the value in using humor in all these different settings? What do you think?
I think this is the greatest thing I've heard coming out of academia in a long time. To my story of tell me a story as a means of getting hired by me, if people coming out of MBA programs who are so self-serious, I mean, when I taught at Harvard, I loved teaching at Harvard. I loved the Institute of Politics, but my students were so self-serious. They were so worried about their next job, their next internship, their next this or that. And I used to say to them, relax, smile, you know, go watch a movie, you know, do something so that you can not at age 30 have a stroke. And I think that introduction of humor in a business program is just the most wonderful thing that these guys should do. They should have 2 or 3 classes in it. And they should have a class in improv as well, because it's the heart of interactions between human beings, humor and comedy and storytelling and the like. And these guys that I think fail in business are the ones that don't get it and don't learn it. And I think it's great. I just think it's great.
You're preaching to the choir, obviously, Michael. We can concur completely.
You remember there's the famous story of the director-screenwriter George Seaton, who goes to visit Edmund Gwenn. Gwenn is the guy who played Santa Claus in Miracle on 34th Street. Yep. And Gwenn is in his bed dying. And Seaton said, you know, to Gwenn, you know, empathetically, he said, this must be so terribly difficult. And Gwenn is supposed to have said, dying is easy. Comedy is hard. and if you get that, you know, so like the business part of it is easy. We're all, you know, educated beyond our intelligence and are able to be alpha people. But comedy is hard. And if you can be both of those, you've got such a leg up on those who can't.
Thank you. That's great. What's the best lawyer joke you've ever heard? And please touch and share on anything you think we may have overlooked.
So when I used to be at the Justice Department as a private consultant, I used to give a lot of speeches. And I used to always start, as is, you know, rule one, with a joke. Paul Volcker, I think it was, chairman of the Federal Reserve, used to use a joke, which I must have heard him say 15 times, because they used to always introduce him as Mr. Chairman. And his joke was, there's a guy who walks into an exotic animal store, and there are 3 parakeets. And the guy says to the owner, what's this price? Pointing at the first parakeet. And he says, that parakeet is $5,000. He says, really? What is that? You know, what does that do for 5,000? He says, you know, he sings arias, he can recite, you know, Shakespeare. It's a beautiful bird. And he says, wow. He points to the middle one. He says, what's the cost of that one? He says, that's 10,000. He says, 10,000? He says, yeah. He says, that guy can do the arias, do Shakespeare, plus he's, you know, he speaks 12 languages, he sings, you know, la, la, la. I said, that's remarkable. And what about the third? And he says, well, the third, I haven't seen him do anything. And that's a $50,000 price tag. And he says, $50,000 for a bird doesn't know things. Yes, but the other two call him Mr. Chairman.
That's beautiful.
I loved that joke. I also used to use this joke, which I think was used once in the movie Hook, where the joke is that research scientists, maybe you've heard this, and you can stop me, it says research scientists are beginning to replace laboratory rats with lawyers. And there are three reasons that they cite. The first is there are more lawyers than rats. Second, researchers don't develop the same affection for the lawyers as they did for the rats. And third, there are just some things you can't ask a rat to do. And so, you know, I used to use those a lot. I liked those jokes. I can go on. There's a third one that I think is lovely too, but I know in the interest of time, I'll hold it unless you want me to say it.
We'll ask you to come back for a part two. Yeah. So we can keep the audience listening. Yeah. But I did want to wrap up by just thanking you so much, Michael. The wisdom and the insights in terms of how you deal with the gravity of the position that you hold, and your use of humor and laughter, and obviously, you know, learning at the side of Benji, your dad, was just a memorable, memorable story. So, Michael Zeldin, legal analyst at CNN, I cannot thank you enough for joining Paul Mershon and I today. And let's stay in touch. Thanks so much.
You're rocking, Michael.
This was a great pleasure. Thank you guys for having me.